This podcast was recorded Thursday, May 24th at 11 a.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear this.
Yeah, like the show Storage Wars will secure the rights to auction off Cliff Rosenberger's locker.
I wonder what they'll find. Let's talk Ohio politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and all the shrewd politicians, the Snollygosters that are out there. I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown. Coming up in the podcast, a discussion about the state of women in Ohio politics.
But first, where do we start? What a week. The FBI raided the home and storage locker of former House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger. Or do we start with the ACLU challenge of Ohio's congressional map 6 years after it went into effect and a month after voters agreed to change the system?
We'll go with the FBI's wake-up call. Last month, Cliff Rosenberger quit suddenly, saying he was doing so because the FBI was asking questions about him. Well, the FBI has moved beyond just asking questions.
Yes, indeed. Early Wednesday, FBI agents showed up, we assume unannounced, and searched Rosenberger's home in Clarksville. He wasn't there. Technically, it is his parents' house. They also searched his storage locker in nearby Wilmington.
Rosenberger reportedly is under investigation in connection with lavish trips he took with lobbyists for the payday lending industry. He says everything he has done is ethical and lawful.
Yet this is just another chapter in this, what the Democrats are going to call, culture of corruption. It just was not a good image for Republicans seeking office this fall to see FBI agents walking in and out of Cliff Rosenberger's house.
It's pretty damning video. It's we don't know what they found. It's certainly horrible optics. It's certainly horrible headlines. Rich Cordray, the Democratic candidate for governor, was quick to come out. He held a teleconference on Wednesday afternoon saying this is what happens when there is unchecked one-party rule in the state house. And this could be bad. I don't know. We have no idea what they found. Maybe they didn't find anything. This does not look good for Republicans at all.
Well, it's when you have to raid someone's home. Rosenberger's attorney was saying that he's cooperating with investigators. Investigators don't raid someone's home if they think that person is being fully cooperative. So the image is there's something to hide, or he's trying to hide something. It came out that and was reported that his campaign treasurer, I believe, helped him take things out of his office around the time he resigned and put it in that storage locker. So we don't know. This is all speculation and media reporting at this point, but it's not a good look. And last night on social media, picture after picture after picture showed Mike DeWine, the candidate for governor, you know, yucking it up with Cliff Rosenberger at campaign events before all this happened. So that's, you can imagine, we're going to see that image all summer long and all fall in negative ads.
And DeWine claims he did advise Rosenberger to resign immediately. Rosenberger initially, when he said he was going to step down, he gave himself a few weeks. DeWine says he called him, talked to him, said, please resign now. That's eventually what Rosenberger ended up doing. But still, there is the connection there with DeWine.
And there's questions there whether it was appropriate for the chief law enforcement officer in Ohio to be communicating with him when there's a possible criminal investigation going on.
Sure, yeah, a lot of questions.
We'll see how it turns out.
Rosenberger's still been he's been mum. No public comments.
No, and that's not surprising. He's under investigation, and you're not going to say anything that could possibly incriminate you down the road.
Let's move now. The raid came as House Republicans are trying to pick a new speaker so they can get back to the business of making laws.
The Ohio House GOP caucus was scheduled to vote on a new speaker Wednesday, but the current acting speaker, Kurt Schuring, canceled it, saying the outcome was uncertain.
This is uncharted territory we're in now, right now, and I still have confidence we'll get there, but I'm not going to roll the dice.
Rolling the dice. Representative Ryan Smith of Bidwell says he is close to securing the votes he needs to become speaker, but he accused his Republican rival Larry Householder of bullying and extorting members.
I believe I had the votes to win, the necessary votes to be speaker. But frankly, in the last week, the tactics, once again, that have been used from bullying to threats to downright extortion is embarrassing.
Now, Larry Householder denies this. Downright extortion, that's a pretty serious charge.
That jumped out at me this morning. Extortion? That's criminal. That's criminal.
If true. Now, Larry Householder is a tough politician, and he is known for using strong-arm politics.
He's known for, quote, storming the castle, as Matt Borges
said. He's a tough politician. Whether it crosses over to extortion, who knows? But it doesn't surprise me that Larry Householder is playing hardball with sitting state reps and state reps who are likely to come back next year. You're saying, support me or we'll penalize you next time.
Smith also saying that there's been some pressure against him from Bill Lager, the owner and founder of the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow, which no longer exists. It closed amid a state fight with the state. Also from the payday lending industry. So Smith really not shy about lobbing the accusations this week.
No, and what hurts him is he's aligned with Cliff Rosenberger. And just as he was going to get the votes to become the new speaker, they're raiding his house. Now, they say the vote was canceled before the raid happened at Rosenberger's house. But let's put that in the it's not helping category.
That conference, that clip of Kirk Schoen we heard came minutes after the FBI raid.
He didn't know about it. I honestly believe he didn't know about the raid at the time, but there was no way they were going to hold that vote.
Now, as they look for a new speaker, this has caused a lot of logistical problems. They can't have a House session without a speaker. And so the biggest bill that's getting delayed by this, probably the payday lending industry interest rate caps.
Yeah, they're supposed to cap the rates for real this time at 28%. This was the one that sort of sparked the controversy with Cliff Rosenberger. The House did an about face and was going to just pass the restrictions without any changes. But that's held up now. And other bills are being held up. They're supposed to be voting on money to update election systems for the 2020 elections. They test them in 2019. And by the 2020 election, the voting systems hopefully will be changed and up to date. But they can't vote on that funding until they have a speaker.
It is a mess. It's still a mess. Let's turn now to Ohio's congressional map. Earlier this month, Ohioans overwhelmingly approved a ballot measure to change how the state redraws its congressional districts.
Issue one is meant to reduce gerrymandering by requiring more minority support for new maps. It also limits how many times counties can be split into different congressional districts.
But that's still not enough to appease the ACLU of Ohio. This week, the Civil Liberties Group filed a federal lawsuit claiming the current map is unconstitutional because it unfairly favors Republicans. Here's the ACLU's legal director, Fred Levinson.
We're seeking a declaration from the court that the current map is unconstitutional. And we're seeking an order from the court that a new map be drawn.
But when pressed by WOSU's Claire Roth, Levinson did not have any concrete suggestions on what the new map should look like.
Typically, states that have bipartisan or nonpartisan commissions that draw the maps come up with maps that are less biased. But we're not asking for any particular mechanism here.
Mike, we are moving to a more bipartisan system, not a completely bipartisan system, but a more bipartisan system. Still, this ACLU case seems to rely on case law. Pennsylvania just had their congressional map thrown out over a similar lawsuit that the ACLU supported. It's just weird timing with the recent passage of issue one.
Yeah, it is. It is weird. Now, before the election, before the primary election, where voters overwhelmingly approved this anti-gerrymandering plan, the ACLU sort of stayed out of the fight.
Yeah, they did not endorse, did not denounce.
They said that they could not endorse the plan because it didn't go far enough to eliminate gerrymandering in Ohio. And it doesn't technically guarantee that gerrymandering will go away. It provides incentives to keep lawmakers from drawing crazy shaped districts, but it will not eliminate gerrymandering. It'll reduce it. It'll offer incentives to avoid it. But the ACLU is right. It's not a guarantee. My guess is they wanted to take Ohio's map to court after the Pennsylvania ruling, which was surprising. And now Pennsylvania's map is also 6 or 8 years old. 6 years old, able to be 8 years old by the time the 2020 elections come around. So maybe they were heartened by the Pennsylvania ruling and wanted to file suit, but didn't want to file suit before the election because that really would have muddied the waters for voters. But now it's just weird that after the election, if I'm a judge, I'm saying, why are we changing it now when voters have said we're going to change it for 2020 anyway, or 2022 anyway?
I'm certainly not an attorney. I would think something that's unconstitutional is unconstitutional regardless of if something else is coming down the road. I would think this case has legs now, given the Pennsylvania precedent. I mean, this is they have case law to refer to.
Yes, and the Pennsylvania districts weren't quite as gerrymandered as Ohio, but they were really gerrymandered. And if you look at the map, it's hard to show maps on a podcast. The new congressional districts, they're very compact. They make sense. It's a nice map. It seems to really represent a distribution of congressional members across the state, unlike the snake on the lake we have here in Ohio, or the Rorschach test that Joyce Beatty's district here is in Ohio, and then the district for Jim Jordan, it goes from southwest Ohio all the way up to the Lorain County and Lavin on Lake Erie. So we'll see how this works out. Do the courts allow the will of the voters to change the system, or do they step in and ask that it be changed immediately? In addition to predictions of a blue wave, we're hearing talk of a pink wave. This year is being called the Year of the Woman in Politics.
This week's primary election in Georgia bolstered that storyline as Stacey Abrams won the Democratic nomination for governor. If elected, she would become the nation's first black woman elected governor.
Here in Ohio, female candidates are on the ballot, but perhaps not in as great a number as in other states. Here are the numbers. Of the 14 statewide major party candidates, 12 are men, 2 are women. They are Lieutenant Governor candidate Betty Sutton and Secretary of State candidate Kathleen Clyde. Both are Democrats.
Female representation in congressional races is a little better. Of the 32 major party candidates running for Congress, 21 are men, 11 are women, 3 of whom are incumbents.
Joining us to discuss this is race and gender studies professor Wendy Smooth. Her focus is the role of women in politics and the impact of public policy on women. Wendy, welcome to Snollygoster.
Great to be here.
Now, let me get this straight. You're a political science professor in courtesy. You're a courteous political science professor. What's the deal there?
So I'm in the Department of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies, and I have a courtesy appointment in political science, which also means that I get all of the fun of doing politics in the department without all of the politics of doing work in the department.
And the Women's Studies Department is just being very courteous by loaning you over to the
Science
Department.
Right. There you go.
Big thanks to them. When it comes to women in politics, how do you think Ohio is doing?
Well, Ohio is, we're lagging behind a bit in terms of where we could be. And if we look historically back to the 1990s, certainly in the state house, women were doing a lot better in the 1990s than we currently see. Some of that has to do with partisan changes. So we know that women candidates tend to fare better in the Democratic Party than they have historically done in the Republican Party. And right now we have, you know, all Republican control, and that is impacting the ways in which we see gender take shape.
The Republicans would argue that they've had, you know, we had a woman lieutenant governor, Jeanette Bradley, a woman attorney general, Betty Montgomery, Joanne Davidson, Speaker of the House, all Republicans.
Powerhouses as well. And so a question becomes, which you guys might be able to help me with as a new student to Ohio politics, is why has Ohio not sealed the deal in terms of a woman governor? Coming from all of that incredible leadership, typically we see the lieutenant governor position as a stepping stone. We actually build it as a pipeline, important pipeline step for women in politics, but it hasn't been realized in Ohio.
Current Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor she was a candidate for governor before losing to Mike DeWine in the GOP primary. She lost big by 20 points.
It's because we live in interesting times, Wendy, in case you haven't noticed.
Yes, lots going on there, right?
John Kasich, the economy's doing well. The state's on the right track. If you look at the polls, he's a fairly popular governor overall. You would think his lieutenant governor, man or woman, would be prime to take over for him, but that's far from the case. It did not happen this year.
Oh, sure. The narrative took a huge turn, a huge swing than what we would, you know, normally expect, right? And that has a lot to do with some of the choices that Mary Taylor made in terms of how to frame her candidacy. She took a very strong detour to the right from Kasich. So it's hard to even associate her with John Kasich
anti-Kasich brand right now.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
That's the sign of the times that we're in and the lane you have to carve for yourself to get votes in a Republican primary.
And interestingly enough, she did a lot of those things really quite well. So coming down very hard on gun control, right? And, you know, a packing mama on the steps of the state house. But we then have to think about how those things play out gender-wise, right? And whether or not those kinds of pivots work well for women candidates.
The image that we remember from the campaign, Mary Taylor's campaign, is she showed up at a gun rally at the state house and had a shotgun over her shoulder.
And did very that, comfortable with it, too.
She was very not, Charlton Heston, basically saying, yeah. Come take it.
Right. There you go.
Does that? It's tougher for a woman to do that, though.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a tougher sell for a woman, because then she's also, you know, crossing lines with a lot of women who are, when we poll women, they say that they are in favor of some more restrictions around gun control. And so that's a much tougher spin for a woman candidate. So you lose kind of some of the base of women voters that you might expect to get otherwise.
When you look at history, you know, we in the media and in the pundit class, we label these years of the women. 1984 was the year of the woman because Geraldine Ferraro ran for vice president with Walter Mondale.
Yes.
1992 was the next real year of the woman when four women were elected to the U.S. Senate, bringing the total to 6 out of 100. Now another year of the woman, but there are 23 women in the U.S. Senate now, still certainly not a majority, but much better than 6. So do we overhype these years of the women? Do we make too much of them? What do you make of these labels we put on things like this?
Sure. For pundits, it's essential for you to have a grip on something, right? And so 1992 delivered, right? We doubled the number of women in the House. But what we also need to be aware of is in 1992, we were also on the cusp of a redistricting cycle. So we had a number of new majority-minority districts that had been drawn. Women of color did quite well in those districts, and almost all of them that constituted that doubling in the House were coming from majority-minority districts. So I think there's some structural things that make 1992 in particular a little different from 2018. But 2018, certainly, we can call it the I loved your pink wave, by the way. Yeah. Pink wave, tidal wave.
Do you think there is a pink wave coming in November?
Well, I say there's a pink wave in terms of the number of candidates. Now, the difference between the number of candidates and wins that we'll see realized, I think, is a little different. And my colleagues across the country who do this work as well have been trying to temper expectations a little bit. Because I think we are, you know, thinking that just because you declare a candidacy, it automatically means you're going to win. And that's not the case, we all know.
Does it take a controversy in 1992? You mentioned there were structural issues, but that was right on the heels of Clarence Thomas and the uproar over Anita Hill and how she was treated before Congress. Obviously, 2018, women are upset with Donald Trump and what he has said and the controversies surrounding him. Do we, again, make too much out of these controversies, or are these controversies real in spurring women candidates to action?
Right. The way that I tend to talk about those are galvanizing moments. And for sure, they are the moments that we see these huge upticks where women who have been on the fence make the decision that, yes, I'm going to go forward. The thing that I kind of take issue with is this idea that the Trump effect is really about women being highly reactive to Trump's election, and they're mad, they're angry, and, you know, remember, they're nasty, right?
Yes.
So,
yeah, according to Elizabeth Warren.
Well, right. Also that the nasty woman comment that Trump leveled at Hillary Clinton.
Oh, sure. And then, you know, the T-shirts after, right? Yeah. So women ran with the nasty comment to reclaim it as a nasty woman speaks her mind, right? And those things are all great, yes. The anger-motivated women, the, you know, conversations. The Access Hollywood tape is still on the minds of a lot of women. However, women are also strategic, they're calculating, and they're shrewd in your snollygaster way, but in a positive, calculating conceptualization of the shrewd politician. They're not just jumping off the couch mad and irrational. Those are the kinds of gender stereotypes that have, you know, inundated the world for centuries and eons. They're rational.
Let's not forget a lot of women voted for Donald Trump.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. In particular, a lot of white women voted for Donald Trump, and the data really shows that distinctly.
Is policymaking different at all with a woman in charge? Is there you talk about how women are calculating and they're quote-unquote snollygosters. Is there a a different dynamic in any political arena when there is a woman in charge, be it governor or Senate or anything else?
Sure. So the research shows us that when we have governing bodies with more women constituting the body moves to more consensus, through more consensus, right? Which then we have to ask this question, don't we need women in this era of polarization?
Is that because there's more of a balance, or is it because women are better at reaching a consensus?
That women do consensus politics, right? That's their style of politics. So to get a conversation built around a topic as opposed to an absolute on a topic. So when we see more women in a body, we see more consensus building. But we also see the types of issues change when we have more women present. And it's not only women who start to think differently about the budget. It's not only women who start to think about these kinds of traditional women's issues like healthcare. You get more men interested and engaged in those issues as well. So it has a profound effect on policy outcomes as well.
We talked about the lack of women running statewide, 2 out of 14, congressional races a little better. It seems like there are more women candidates running for lower races, state rep, state senate maybe. Have you done any research on that? Do you know how we're doing there?
Sure.
In Ohio?
Yes. So across the board, one of the things that we always see is that women will take that initial step at lower offices and do this kind of stair step ladder climbing to statewide office and even to offices in the state house. So when we look at what's happening in 2018, I'm more encouraged by looking down seat to look at the local level, to look at even our school boards. It's hard for us to get the data around those things to do the kind of analysis I like to do. But if we are seeing more candidates at that level, it really bodes well for what we're able to see in 2020 and beyond. So I'm thinking more long-term pipeline building that we'll see out of 2018. So I'm not at all discouraged if 2018 doesn't result in this huge, you know, women's takeover of every legislative branch, which it won't. But I'm not discouraged by that. I'm encouraged by the ways in which women are stepping forward. If they're taking that seat in the on the city council, if they're taking that seat in the, you know, the commissioner's race, then that's great because I'll see them again later.
If you had to put on a political consultant's hat, how would you advise a woman running for office in Ohio in 2018? Are there certain issues they need to talk about, certain things that make them more popular? I don't know. Is there any advice you would offer to a female candidate?
So it depends on the race. It depends on where you're running.
Mm-hmm.
Will depend on what I would necessarily tell you to do.
Are there any big do's or don'ts?
So I think in the state of Ohio, I would still say that if you have children under the age of 5, might not be a great idea to take them out initially on the campaign trail. And I know that's controversial to say, but I think in the state of Ohio, we still are not one of those states that can fully understand how is it possible for a woman to do it all? How are you going to commute from Toledo down to Columbus and be a good parent? And those are conversations that we used to have in the 1980s and early 90s around women candidates, but I think it's still a conversation that's relevant in a state like Ohio.
Thanks very much, Wendy Smooth, race and genders professor at Ohio State and very courteous political science professor as well. Thanks for joining us here on Snollygoster.
Great to join you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, time now for our weekly segment, John Kasich GPS.
Ohio, Governor Kasich, welcome back to Meet the Press.
Thanks, Chuck. So,
Governor, welcome back to Fox News Sunday.
We went to Tulsa instead of where we were going in Colorado.
I think I've eaten my way across the entire state of New York.
Ground control to Major Tom. Help me.
Each week we check in on the governor's GPS to find out where he has brought his national campaign for whatever it might be. This week he went to Massachusetts. He was at Harvard speaking to graduates at the John F. Kennedy School of Government.
You want to fix this country? You fix it where you live. And you knit together in a network of people who seek the truth, who are objective and rational, and you'll fix the country.
So John Kasich, in his speech anyway, avoided overt talk of politics, but his biggest applause line didn't come from him. It came from the person who introduced him when he said that John Kasich stood up to Donald Trump. The crowd seemed to like that. So politics was definitely in the air in Cambridge, but not in the governor's speech.
He did stand up to Donald Trump. He lost, but he tried to stand up to Donald Trump. Still no word yet on whether Kasich went to the Rock on the Range Festival this week. That's the heavy metal three-day rock festival here in Columbus at Crew Stadium. He has been seen jamming there before with his daughters.
Yes, it was pretty funny. So just in case the governor did not make it to Rock on the Range, we have some Godsmack this week. Godsmack, one of the favorites of headbangers at Rock on the Range. Remember to tell your friends about Snollygoster. Give us a good rating on iTunes, whatever you can do to help spread the word.
Until next week, I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster.